Thank you, Kathy. So part of what I am going to be speaking about in my sermon today has to do with how matter and spirit are related. And one of the possibilities I will mention is that one can look at the relationship of matter and spirit as two poles of one larger reality, and further, that you can look at that larger reality from the perspective of either pole. The reading I have is a kind of whimsical poem of American poet Mary Oliver, in which she looks at the larger reality from the pole of spirit. Her poem is titled simply Poem, and you should be able to follow the words on the screen as I read it. There they are. Poem by Mary Oliver. The spirit likes to dress up like this: 10 fingers, 10 toes, shoulders, and all the rest, at night in the black branches, in the morning in the blue branches of the world. It could float, of course, but would rather plumb rough matter. Airy and shapeless thing, it needs the metaphor of the body, lime and appetite, the oceanic fluids. It needs the body's world, instinct and imagination, and the dark hug of time, sweetness, and tangibility to be understood, to be more than pure light that burns where no one is. So it enters us in the morning, shines from brute comfort like a stitch of lightning, and at night lights up the deep and wondrous drownings of the body like a star. Another thing I will be speaking about in my sermon is the status of spirits. Are they to be received literally, symbolically, metaphorically? What is their status? One of the very popular songs in my young adulthood, known, I suspect, to many of you, is the very lively song Spirit in the Sky, composed, recorded, and released in 1969 by songwriter Norman Greenbaum. Spirit in the Sky was Greenbaum's only hit, but it was a big one. A world hit, really, ranked by Rolling Stone as number 333 on its list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Now, Greenbaum did compose other songs that he hoped might also catch on, but when his other albums didn't go anywhere, he gave up his music career and became first a cook and then a chef in California. Greenbaum, of Jewish heritage, said that he spent a good bit of time working on the music of Spirit in the Sky, but only about 15 minutes on the lyrics, and admitted that he knew nothing about Orthodox Christian theology, which is abundantly clear from the verse that begins, "Never been a sinner, I never sinned," a sentiment that does not exactly or even remotely reflect Orthodox Christian doctrine, for which Greenbaum received a boatload of critical response. Nevertheless, in 2011, Greenbaum was quoted as saying, "Spirit in the Sky sounds as fresh today as when it was recorded. I've gotten letters from funeral directors telling me that it's their second most requested song to play at memorial services, next to Danny Boy." I found multiple video versions of Spirit in the Sky on the internet. The one I've selected includes some lovely images that accompany this lively, spirited song, Spirit in the Sky, by Norman Greenbaum. George? We'll be right back. You enjoyed that. Well, my two sermons with you this past summer, as well as sermons that I've given for other congregations this summer and in the early fall, have related directly to the current social and political scene in our country. And though, of course, there's always plenty to address on that front, this Sunday and next, I'm giving the social political scene a rest. And I'll be speaking on what I typically refer to as the spiritual dimension of life. Some years ago, I gave an 8-part sermon series on this subject to the Quimper Fellowship here in Port Townsend. And what you'll be getting this week and next are some of the main ideas from that series. My aim in this first week is to try to get a handle on the words spirit and spiritual. Not an easy task. They are so slippery, used so variously. My Webster's Dictionary, for example, lists 15 different meanings of the word spirit. This morning, I'm going to briefly explore 6 different ways in which we commonly speak of spirit or the spiritual dimension of life. And since the sermon will be covering a lot of territory, I provided an outline of the sermon that was emailed to you earlier in the week and also this morning. You're invited to use that if you think it might be helpful to keep track of the different meanings of spirit that I'll be addressing this morning. And also, I'm going to make a print version of the sermon available to you afterwards. So, what do we mean when we use the words spirit or spiritual? Let's begin with spirit as the animating principle of life. What makes living beings alive? What gives them their vitality? The answer is spirit. Spirit is a word that we use to refer to the life principle, the vital, dynamic, animating, activating aspect of living beings. Without spirit, there is no life. From ancient times, spirit, as the activating life principle, has been connected with the breath. For breath is that which is moving and active and dynamic and in a being. So long as a creature is breathing, it is alive. When the breath stops, the body grows cold, it is no longer alive or animated. Its spirit, we say, has departed. Because of this common experience, the words for spirit in many languages are connected with breath. In Hebrew, for example, spirit is ruach, whose root means breath. In Greek, pneuma has to do with breath. In Latin, the word is spiritus, and in German, it's Geist. As the principle that makes one alive, a person full of vitality may be said to be spirited or inspired. Lacking such vitality, a person is said to be dispirited. Thus, a spiritual life or a life of the spirit has a lot to do with paying attention to what it is that keeps one vital and alive. What makes you come alive? Where is the energy in your life? A spiritual life, then, can be understood as following that energy. Following that energy can be understood and seen as your spiritual path. Keeping track of that energy is staying on your spiritual path. Hinduism, for example, speaks of four basic spiritual paths or margas, four basic ways that one may track and express the spirit, the vital energy of life, four different yogas. They say yoga means union. One's yoga is one's way of spiritual union, that is, union with the vital energy as it manifests in you. And the four main yogas or spiritual paths of Hinduism are the way of meditation, Raja Yoga, the way of knowledge or discrimination, Jnana Yoga, don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Thirdly, there is the way of devotion or love, which you will have heard of, Bhakti Yoga. And then finally, the way of works or service, Karma Yoga. In the sermon series, I mentioned that I gave in Port Townsend, I devoted an entire sermon in that series to these spiritual paths. Don't have time to go into that today. But at any rate, one usage and understanding of the word spirit has to do with the animating vital energy of one's life. A second understanding of spirit is as the non-material side of life. Throughout history, we humans have found it helpful and even necessary to conceptualize life not just with one term, but with two basic terms. Thus, we have spoken of material reality, that which is available to our five senses and ruled by space and time. This is the physical, concrete stuff of life that we can touch, taste, see, hear, and feel. But this has not been enough. There's more to reality, another dimension, a non-material dimension that we speak of as the spiritual dimension. Now, of course, this dimension is more difficult to get a handle on because it's non-physical, non-spatial, non-temporal, and unavailable to the five senses in a direct way. Let me give you three models or paradigms of how these material and spiritual dimensions are conceived and related to each other. One is to see the spiritual dimension as prior to and preceding the material dimension. To see the spiritual dimension as the source of the material dimension, the invisible source out of which all visible forms are but temporary and changing manifestations. The Hindus, for example, speak of the spiritual as the eternal, unchanging dimension that puts on and throws off material forms, just as a person puts on and takes off clothing. And this is known as philosophical idealism. A second way of relating the spiritual and the material dimensions is the other way around. That is, to see the material dimension as the source of the spiritual, and the spiritual then as the flowering of the material dimension. This is philosophical materialism or philosophical naturalism, in which spirit evolves from matter. Matter is the source of spirit, and spirit is the fragrance or bouquet or flowering of matter. Matter comes to self-consciousness. Matter becomes aware of itself, and thus matter is no inert thing, but something imbued with spiritual potential. Theologian Paul Tillich, for example, uses the term ecstatic naturalism. Ecstatic, not static, but ecstatic naturalism. Nature in ecstasy, matter blossoming into spirit. And then a third way of relating the material and spiritual dimensions is to see them as two poles of one larger reality. In this approach, it's not so much that matter emerges out of spirit or spirit emerges out of matter, but that all things are ever and always both matter and spirit, with neither being the product or the manifestation of the other. They exist rather like this coin. Two sides, so that one could describe the coin from the spiritual side or the material side. It just depends on which side you're looking at. And yet together, they form one inseparable reality. Even a stone could be looked at from the side of spirit. You could say, a bit playfully, that the spirit of hardness and opaqueness has become concrete or physical in a stone. Or again, you could define each pole in terms of the other. Matter is the physical or outward expression of spirit. Spirit is the animating or inward expression of matter. Author Charles Baudelaire puts it this way. He says, the natural world is a spiritual house. We walk through forests of physical things, which are also spiritual things that gaze upon us with affectionate looks. A third understanding of the spiritual dimension has to do with a kind of spiritual world, or a world of spirits. This is the realm populated by gods and goddesses, demons and devils, angels and archangels, souls of the departed, ghosts and fairy tale figures, sprites and gnomes and nymphs and elves and leprechauns, spirits of all sorts. Spirit in the sky, as that spirited song we heard earlier by Norman Greenbaum puts it. Now, the question that comes up with respect to this understanding of the spiritual dimension is what status to give it. Are there, in fact, spiritual beings, that is, beings that exist but without material form? And if they exist, what is their nature, and how do they relate to the material plane? The tendency with the coming of science is either to completely reject this realm, for which it is difficult to get scientific validation, or to hold on to it literally and dogmatically. A third way, however, one that I prefer, is to interpret this realm of the spirits in a symbolic, mythological, or metaphorical way. That is, this realm of spirits is not literal, but yet real. Real in expressing qualities and potentialities of the human spirit and of life in general. And so I think it's important both to recognize the difference between the literal and the metaphorical, and to keep those distinctions clean, but also not to dismiss the metaphorical or mythological realm, because without that realm, the human imagination would suffer a great loss. A fourth understanding of spirit and the spiritual dimension has to do with certain disciplines or practices that are called spiritual. And these are many and varied: meditation, prayer, chanting, journal work, dream work, drumming, yoga, tai chi, participation in one of the arts, gardening, walking, any number of spiritual disciplines. Again, I have detailed these in another series of sermon. I don't have time to go over that today, but the point of these disciplines is to focus one's attention on the life of the spirit, to quiet the spirit, restore the spirit, center the spirit, deepen the spirit, open the spirit, enlarge the spirit, lift the spirit, adjust the spirit, and to enable one's spirit to be more gentle, more kindly, more loving, compassionate, more generous, more gracious, more humble, more forgiving, less judgmental. Thus, and this is an important point, it's not the activity itself that is spiritual. Rather, these activities, disciplines, and practices can be called spiritual by virtue of their focus and intention. And there's often some confusion here, so that we mistake the spiritual discipline or practice for the spiritual life. Spiritual disciplines and practices are not ends in themselves, and teachers of the life of the Spirit have been aware of the temptation of their students and followers to be thrown off the spiritual path by the very disciplines or practices that are supposed to lead to a greater appreciation of the life of the Spirit. To be thrown off the path, for example, by miracles or by exotic and paranormal occurrences. Thus, Jesus, for example, would give no demonstration of power to those who asked for a sign or a miracle. This was not of the Spirit. One of my favorite stories in this regard is a teaching story that comes out of Buddhism and goes like this. One day a disciple rushed to his teacher in great excitement, crying, "Master, Master, I finally done it. After all these years of fasting, of meditation, of concentration, study, and practice, I've finally done it. I've walked on water all the way across the river." "Oh, that's too bad," said the teacher in dismay. "Didn't I tell you? I meant to tell you. I should have told you. I'm sorry I didn't tell you, but just up the river, there's a ferry. And you could have crossed there at any time for only a nickel." You could perhaps compare spiritual disciplines and exercises to physical disciplines and exercises. Just as physical exercises are meant to tend the body, so spiritual exercises are meant to tend the spirit. These disciplines and practices don't make us spiritual persons, because we are already spiritual persons, but they may help to bring the spiritual dimension to greater awareness in us and to deepen our experience with it. Moving on then to a fifth understanding of spirit, and this has to do with certain experiences that we call spiritual experiences. As in a common statement we might make, it was a spiritual experience, which may apply quite broadly to occasions in which we feel ourselves related, connected, or even identified with that which is greater than ourselves. And at its height, one may feel lifted, as it were, out of one's body, out of one's everyday, ordinary reality to touch the fullness of being, to catch, as it were, a glimpse of the face of God, an experience of beauty, wonder, harmony, of sublimity and exaltation. I found, for example, in adult religious education classes that I've led, when I ask folks to relate what they regard as a religious or spiritual experience, it is typically this kind of experience that is spoken of, an experience in which the boundaries between things blur, all division falls away, things come together and cohere, waves of love roll over one, and one experiences, if only fleetingly, a sense of the unity and oneness of things, which includes even one's own limited and very finite particle of being. Such experiences, though fleeting, seem to us to touch the very essence of life and being, and are viewed as touchstones to which we may return time and again in the routine of daily life. Our faith, says Ralph Waldo Emerson playfully, our faith comes in moments, our vice is habitual. Now, there are any number of examples in literature I could give. Let this one from Annie Dillard's book, Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek, suffice. Annie Dillard writes, "Then one day, I was walking along Tinker Creek, thinking of nothing at all, and I saw the tree with the lights in it. I saw the backyard cedar where the mourning doves roost charged and transfigured, each cell buzzing with flame. I stood on the grass with the lights in it, grass that was holy fire, utterly focused and dreamed. It was less like seeing than like being for the first time seen, knocked breathless by a powerful glance. The flood of fire abated, but I'm still spending the power. Gradually, the lights went out in the cedar. The colors died. The cells unflamed and disappeared. I was still ringing. I had been my whole life a bell and never knew it until at that moment I was lifted and struck." And then finally this morning, spirit can be understood not only as a certain type of experience, but also as a quality of awareness. Now, this is an understanding of spirit that I picked up from my main mentor in the ministry, the Reverend Dr. Duncan Littlefair, who was for 38 years the senior minister at the Fountain Street Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where As Kathy indicated earlier, I was an associate minister for 22 years. Dr. Littlefair wrestled intensely with the nature of spirit, particularly in the latter years that I knew him. What is spirit, he wanted to know. How does it develop? His philosophy was a naturalistic one, so he wanted to know, how does spirit emerge and relate to matter? At his death, I wrote a eulogy in which I tried to summarize his understanding of spirit. And I'm going to close this first sermon in this two-part series with a part of that eulogy that reads as follows. For Duncan Littlefair, the spirit can be understood as both the capacity for and the expression of a certain quality in our life, namely a quality of awareness, attention, discernment, and gratitude for the miracle of our life. The spirit, Duncan said, is no incendiary flame, but rather, quote, the still small voice. It is, he said, so quiet, so soft. It is, quote, the stir of wonder that may quietly marvel at any natural event. Though born of the natural physical life, the spirit stands apart from nature in wonder and amazement. The spirit, Duncan said, is, quote, a homely thing and can be easily overlooked by both ourselves and others. But the spirit, he said, doesn't care whether it is seen or not, because it is itself a quality of seeing. It is, he said, quote, a feeling of awareness, or, quote, a feeling awareness. The spirit can also be overlooked, he said. Why? Because it is so non-productive. The spirit doesn't have anything to do with achievement or production of any kind. It is the quality of awareness with respect to achievement, but not the achievement itself. It takes, said Dr. Littlefair, a long time to, quote, grow a spirit. Cultivation of the spirit, he provocatively quipped, can't really begin before age 40. And please note that he was in his 80s when he made this statement. The spirit, this quality of awareness, he said, is always in danger of, quote, being crushed by the physical and material dimension of life. And he said, the spirit is difficult to hold in many circumstances, not just in poverty and physical pain and debilitation, but also in relation to getting on in the world. We are so much with the world that we have no time for reflection, gratitude, or appreciation. On the other hand, sometimes the awareness of spirit emerges out of very difficult circumstances, even disasters. This quality of awareness and appreciation, once felt, Dr. Littlefair said, can, quote, insert itself into all our life. Once we catch this spirit as the quality of awareness, we may recognize it as the essence and aim of being human. And he said it will therefore have ethical and social consequences. A person who has found and developed this quality of awareness will eschew cruelty, violence, hatred, jealousy, and subjection of others. Such a person will seek to lighten the load of others so that they too might experience more fully the possibility of the life of the spirit. This has been a brief survey of six common ways we use the words spirit and spiritual. In next week's sermon, titled What is Soul, I'm going to distinguish and contrast the meanings and values of these two words, spirit and soul. Our closing words are from the Reverend Dr. Richard S. Gilbert, who says this for closing words. As we leave this community of the spirit, may we remember the difficult lesson that each day offers more things than we can do. May we do what needs to be done, postpone what does not, and be at peace with what we can be and do. Therefore, may we learn to separate that which matters most and that which matters least of all. And Kathy, will you please lead us in extinguishing the chalice?